This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about why you should have a contract as a self-employed or freelancer worker. I am joined today by barrister Mr. Tim Sampson from Lamb Chambers in London. Tim is a senior barrister who is regularly instructed to deal with disputes in the High Court, and he also works on serious disputes in the County Court. Additionally, Tim lectures and writes on specialist areas of the law, and he has taught on professional training courses run by the BPP University. Thank you very much for joining me today, Tim.
It's a pleasure as always, Hattie. You know, may I like to be back on these recordings.
Yes, indeed. It's great having you back. We've done so many interesting areas. And this is, as I was just explaining to you before we pressed record, this was actually a topical issue that a lot of listeners wanted us to cover. So starting work with a new client can be an exciting experience, and certainly starting out on your own, which, you know, many people have either done or considered doing as a result of losing their employment due to the pandemic. But what if the relationship with your client goes wrong and you have no contract in place? The government reported that as of June 2020, there were more than 5 million self-employed people in the UK, accounting for over 15% of the working population. MicroBizMag reported that in 2020, there were over 2 million freelance businesses in the UK, and for the majority, over 1.77 million, working as a freelancer is their main occupation and means of income. I mean, the self-employed and freelance industry are really important to our economy. Just the self-employed are contributing over £305 billion a year to our economy, whilst freelancers are currently contributing approximately £1.25 billion to our economy every year. So I asked him this, Tim. The law doesn't require us to have a contract in place, you know, when you're conducting business. But why is it important to have some form of contract in place if someone is working as a freelancer or as a self-employed person?
Well, Hattie, I would say that actually you do end up with a contract. It just may not be the contract that you want is the problem. You need a contract, first and foremost, to make sure you actually get paid what you're entitled to. It's not being properly particularised. Disputes will arise. You'll say, I'm entitled to X, and your employer miraculously will say, well, I think you're entitled to Y, and Y will be smaller. You need a contract to set out what it is you're expected to do, what it is that's not in the contract, so you can't get this creeping contract situation where the employer expects ever more from you, and far more than you thought you were actually obliged to do, because if it's not in writing, you don't know. You can't. There's no basis to have a dispute on that. There's also serious issues to do with tax and insurance, your personal tax and, of course, for your employer. If you are self-employed, it should be absolutely clear you're employed on that basis by an employer, because otherwise they could find themselves facing employers' national insurance contributions.
Yes.
So everyone needs to be covered by this. And of course, the tax man is now very astute to what they call sham self-employed situations that are entered into simply to avoid employers' national insurance. So you don't want HMRC breathing down your neck about what might be regarded as a sham employment situation. And then at the moment, of course, there is just one final additional issue. Where and when are you meant to provide these services? The rules are now that you're not supposed to be out of the house, even for employment purposes, unless you can't do your work from home. So if you are going to have to be working away from home at the moment, the contract should make absolutely clear why that is the case, so you can actually operate within the law.
Yes. Well, that's actually a very good point. And I have to say, you know, when you engage with a client to provide services or goods, it's all with the best will in the world, isn't it? Nobody intends really to do business and to fall out in any shape or form. But people can quickly forget what was agreed. And I think that that's really important, because I have certainly seen over the years where people have come and said, you know, I've got an issue with a supplier or with somebody that I'm providing my work to. What did you agree? And there you go. They scuff around trying to look for emails and text messages and, you know, correspondence that they had and what was agreed. And sometimes people genuinely do forget what was agreed and have a different conception of what was agreed. So, you know, the points that you raise are so, so key. Outline what it is you're going to do, how, when, and the remuneration point, again, really, really key. But the last points that you raised, Tim, I didn't even think about those. You're absolutely right. You know, how do you prove to HMRC that you're self-employed? How do you, as somebody who's engaging with a freelancer or engaging with a self-employed person, prove that that person is self-employed and is a freelancer if you haven't got a contract in place to say, well, here you go, here's our terms of work, here's our terms of business? I mean, what's interesting is that the Money Supermarket reported the most popular sectors for freelancing in the UK. The top five were business support, design, writing and translation, sales and marketing, video, photo and audio. Now, they are not industries that you can't really say, well, it's going to be very tricky or difficult or for somebody working in those sectors to put together some form of contract. The other self the five top self-employed sectors were construction, professional scientific and technical activities, human health and social work activities, wholesale, retail and repair of motor vehicles, and administrative support. So again, I say those industries are not really such where, you know, with the wealth of knowledge that you can get online, you can't put something very simple together. So let's talk about the most important points to include in a contract, Tim, no matter how simple it may be. And we're talking about it can be one page.
But obviously you can go very simple on contracts, but the absolute critical factor in any contract is who the parties to the contract are. Now you may think, well, I'm self-employed, it must be me. Right, let's work through this. It could be me contracting as Tim Sampson. It could be me contracting with Tim Sampson trading as, and give a trading name, but that still means I'm liable, or I could be trading through a limited liability company, each of which has slightly different legal ramifications. Again, with the person who is employing you as the self-employed person or freelancer, you've got to know who is actually doing the employing. Is it the individual you're dealing with? Is it an individual operating through a trading company, as the trading as style, or a limited company? Because you may get into a situation where you think you're contracting with somebody, and in fact, you've just contracted with a limited liability company that has no assets at all. So if something goes wrong, you get nothing.
Or indeed, the person that said to you, come along and provide us with these services, are somebody that works in the company that doesn't actually have authority to give you this business, you know?
Getting the parties to a contract is absolutely crucial. Because if you ever want to have redress later, you have to sue the right party.
Yes.
And if you don't know who that is, or you've got the wrong one, you've failed at the outset. Then the next most important thing is the date the contract comes into effect. Either it's the date it's been signed, but that's not necessarily the most important date, because there may be an effective date. For example, I sign a contract today to start work in July. The effective date of the contract is July, although it was actually signed in February. So make sure you know your obligations kick in.
That's very important, actually, Tim, because most people, and I certainly did for many, many years, think that when you sign something, that's the date it's effective from. Now, that may obviously be the case for some documentations, but in this case, what we're saying is the contract needs to specify in itself the date that the work will start and commence from, irrespective of the signature dates on the contract.
Well, yes, because a lot of these contracts may be entered into on a sort of future basis. I need you to come and work for me in 3 months' time or 6 months' time. For example, if you're doing freelance work, say, in the holiday and catering industry. It may be they're looking for employees for the summer season now. You'll sign the contract today, but you won't be receiving any pay or doing any work for 3 or 4 months. So you need to be absolutely clear when it is your obligations kick in to do anything and when you can expect to be paid. In terms of obligations, the contract should always set out, I think as we've discussed, what it is you should do. But there's a second issue here. If those conditions, those obligations are going to change, the contract should specify that variations to the contract should be in writing. It's no yes. good saying 6 months down the road, oh, but you agreed over the phone.
Yes.
Because nobody remembers entirely accurately what may or may not have been agreed. It may no longer be convenient for them to remember exactly what was agreed. So always get variations to contracts in writing. It doesn't need to have a separate signed document, but at the very least, evidenced in writing, emails, a letter, something that you can...
Yes, and something simply so such as in line with the contract dated and whatever that was dated, here is a variation that we have agreed in the service or the product that we're going to be supplying. Something as simple as that, and then somebody, you know, if it's in an email, responds to you and says, agreed. It doesn't need to be anything more than that, does it?
Yes. I mean, for example, let's say you're supplying goods as part of your contract. You're self-employed, people may do. You've agreed to manufacture something and send it off. You can't do it by the specified date. If you don't get that agreed in writing, you're technically then in breach of the contract.
Of your own contract.
When you don't deliver on time. And you could be sued on that. So it's always worth making sure that any changes to how the contract is to be delivered is put in writing, so there can't be an argument later
yes.
about what was expected of you or what you were going to be doing for your employer.
Yes.
That brings me on to sort of maybe a slightly technical point, but you also ought to build in a right to terminate. If, for example, you're not being paid in accordance with the contract, that is a fundamental breach of the contract, but you ought to have a term that says, if you don't pay me, I'm no longer obliged to provide the services.
And your payment terms. So, for example, we will accept, we've got a 7-day payment terms, or 14-day payment terms, or 30-day, and in breach of that, within, say, 14 days of a notice being sent that payment is now overdue, we have a right to terminate this contract and this relationship.
Yes. I mean, some areas of the law have very specific payment term built into the statutory provisions. I'm thinking mainly the construction industry here. We don't really need to think about that, the general terms, but a right, an absolute right to terminate on notice if you don't get paid or the other, or your employer doesn't meet their obligations is a useful fallback. Because if you rely on that, you cannot then yourself be in breach of the contract to say, I'm not doing any more work.
And also, you leave yourself open less to being sued by a potential client that will say, because you didn't deliver your services and your products, I then suffered a loss, and these are my financial losses I suffered because you didn't turn up or you didn't deliver, and therefore I'm coming after you. So I think there's two very key points there, Tim.
Yes. And there are also other general boilerplate clauses that get put into contracts, but mainly they won't have much impact on these sort of relationships. For example, law and jurisdiction. Now, normally the law is going to be the law of England and Wales in this
country. But it's important to state that, isn't it, Tim? It's important to state, obviously, if your business is being conducted in the UK, England and Wales, to say the law of England and Wales will govern this contract.
That, I mean, it's important, but it's usually accepted that that will be the case anyway. The more important issue is the jurisdiction point. Normally, if you get a breach of contract, you go to court, but it may be that your contract or the contract you have with your employer will require mediation or alternative dispute resolution or arbitration to be attempted before any court proceeding. So you need to consider how any dispute will be escalated before you actually get the right to pull the trigger on court proceedings. You may decide that you want to have a mediation clause in your contract, or an arbitration clause, or some form of alternative dispute resolution, because that will be a lot quicker and cheaper for you in terms of actually getting any sort of enforcement.
Yes. No, indeed. And
to be forced into court proceedings, which are going to take 18 months, cost you a small fortune.
Yes.
And no, there's no guarantee. I mean, even if you think you have a watertight case, there's no such thing as an unlosable case.
No, indeed. And what about things like witness signatures? Is it key, is it sensible to get witnesses to witness the signatures of you and a witness to witness the signature of your client? Is it, you know, advised to do that? Is it a must?
No. I mean, in the days of requiring contracts to be under seal and witness, it's really a bit of old-fashioned. What you do require is that it's evidenced in writing. And it's preferable if documents are signed, but signed can now include electronic signatures.
Yes.
They're just as binding as someone taking their quill pen out and signing the parchment.
Well, I have to say, you know, there were certain documents that you had to provide a wet signature. You couldn't provide an electronic signature or provide a photocopy of the document with your signature. But now, given, you know, the state of the world and obviously what the pandemic has brought with everybody having to be based at home, electronic signatures are now, I think, acceptable more than ever, which, you know, is fair enough. But there was a time, I think, when people wanted to see, and what, you know, like you say, it's been an old-fashioned term, an original wet signature. So let's talk about the actual contract itself. And, you know, some people feel, and I understand it, that if they put a contract under the nose of their new client or there's this great new relationship that they've been able to secure, particularly given that, you know, businesses are struggling, so any new business is great business, and they feel that it's just going to, you know, be looked to frowned upon a little bit. They don't want to agitate their client. Could they call their contract terms of business instead of contract? Would that work?
Well, yes, there's no reason. There's no magic in the word contract. Just so long as it is clear that the terms are intended to have contractual effect, i.e. you're bound to provide the services and they're bound to pay you for them at a most basic level.
Yes.
What you actually put at the top of the document isn't so important. What I would say, though, of course, is that there can be a real power issue here. You may wish to go along as the self-employed person or the freelancer, say, I want to offer my services to you as the employer on my terms and conditions. However, the employer may turn around and say, well, that's lovely. However, we only contract on our terms and conditions. So if you find yourself in that position, I know we're moving slightly away from the question, but it's an important one. If you find yourself in that scenario, you do need to check what it is that you are signing up to. Don't just blindly accept out of enthusiasm the employer's terms. You may find them extremely onerous.
Well, actually, it's not veering off of the question at all, because what we were going to roll into is at what point should people seek legal advice? And obviously people are trying to, you know, not have legal expenses at any stage of their life, of course, but surely that's a good time to seek some advice if you've gone along with your two pages of A4 or one sheet of A4 and say, here's my T's and C's, here's my terms and conditions, my contract, my terms of business, can we please sign this? And you get, boof, a 20, 30 plus page document put in front of your nose and you're being told, well, we only do business on our terms, Mr. Self-Employed and Mr. Freelancer. Surely that's a good time to just seek a little bit of advice to make sure that what you're signing as an individual conducting business with any business that is capable of putting that level of document in front of you, that your rights are not being infringed and that you're not signing everything away and you have, you know, no recompense if things go wrong.
Well, I would certainly recommend it, because if, for example, the employer contract is fair and reasonable, the lawyer will tell you. But what you may find is that it contains restrictive covenants on working with other parties down the road. That may not be something that you can wish to sign up to, but if you sign up to it and that acted on that basis, it's too late. I would certainly say it's worth getting legal advice in those circumstances. And also, if you are regularly contracting under a freelance arrangement or self-employed arrangement, get a lawyer to draw you up a basic set of terms and conditions that are acceptable. Because if you go along with something that's a little homemade, you put the power back into the hands of the employer. They say, well, this is a basic set of terms and conditions. It's not sufficient. What you want is this lovely, shiny 30-page contract that we have already had drawn up. And that's why we have to contract on that basis. So if you've got something that is
good enough and good professional enough, yeah.
Then you could say, well, we don't need that because actually I've already, these are my terms and conditions and this is being drawn up by lawyers on my behalf and this is how I contract.
You know, I will say here that I would strongly suggest that anybody looking to get a contract drawn up, Tim, comes to a barrister. And obviously you're listening to one here who's very capable of that. I honestly, I have no disrespect to solicitors and everything else, but I've only the other day, saw a document. Actually, Tim, I think we both saw the document with a potential client who contracted on an agreement that wasn't worth the paper it was written on. And some form of solicitor's advice was taken. And unfortunately, they didn't advise correctly. So I would say if you're going to get a contract drawn up for you, so you can conduct business and you want it to be robust, it's worth spending a few pounds on a good barrister. You could go direct access or you could go through a law firm and say, I would like to go to a barrister to have a proper contract drawn up. Red Bar Law, my law firm, do fixed fees on legal services. So you can consider that. But for God's sake, get a barrister to do it, because I think it's that key and that important that it actually is absolutely nailed. If you're going to do it, you do it once and then you can provide it to all your clients, all your customers and all your areas that you're providing services to.
Well, yes, and there are other issues here as well. For example, let's say you provide services and maybe provide goods alongside it. You may well have insurance if you get sued. Your insurer will expect to see the contract that you are acting under if you're going to claim under that insurance policy.
It's very, very, very good point.
And often you will be expected, let's say you're providing decorating services. You're providing warranties for that work. So your contractual obligation to the recipient doesn't just end the day you walk out of the offsite. You have ongoing obligations. Again, if this hasn't been properly written into the contract, what are those ongoing obligations? What are you meant to do if something goes wrong? Who is going to be responsible? So again, this all needs to be specified in advance. It's no good thinking of it after the event. And a lot of self-employed and freelancers, of course, are also, the sort of fields they work in tend to be things like music, theatre, performance,
design, well, writing, translation, sales, marketing. There's lots of really key professions here.
But those key professions also raise issues of copyright and moral rights and performers' rights. If I am a musician and I'm playing and it gets recorded, what are my rights? I know what the Copyright Act says about my rights. What does my contract say about those rights? Obviously, the more senior you get in the profession, the more you may well know what those rights are. But at a junior end, just coming into a profession, you may not realise that you have certain copyright and moral rights and performers' rights that you're entitled to enforce. If that's going to be the case, get it in the contract.
No, absolutely.
There'll be no doubt later who actually owns the rights. And the absolute classic scenario here is the independent software producer. And this cuts both ways, both to employer and contractor. If I, as the contractor, produce a new computer program, well, I'm the author of the computer program. Therefore, the employer, who has just paid me a small fortune to
develop it,
that software, doesn't actually own it.
But there you go. And that is such a good example, because I would think if I'm the paying client and I've contracted a developer to develop me a piece of work, whether it's a software program, a piece of music, that I automatically would own it because I'm paying for it. It's very interesting, Tim, because a few years ago, I tried to engage with a photographer, needed some professional photos done and things like that. And they said, oh, but you won't, you'd have to let us know where you're posting your photos. And I thought, well, hold on, I'm paying you for the photo session. The photos are of me personally, the professional photos, but yet I won't own the rights to my own photos. I found it absurd. And I didn't ultimately use that photographer. But what that information did give me is when I did come to the right photographer and found it, I said, am I going to own my own work? Is it all going to be mine? And that was confirmed. But it's very important, because I think it's, having terms of business or a contract, however you dress it up, in place, gives both the service giver and the service receiver no doubt about what has been agreed. And if disputes arise, it just narrows the issues. Hopefully, a dispute can be actually resolved by taking a look at the contract, a good close look at the contract. And this is why I say, you know, yes, if you can't afford to go and spend any money on legal fees to get something robust drawn up, for God's sake, draw it up yourself. But if you are being asked to sign something that's quite robust, take some advice, because you could be signing a lot away that actually doesn't leave you with any rights to do much when things go wrong. Let's now quickly, and I know we're running out of time, but I just want to address this, because obviously this is what most people could be asking. What would be the first thing that someone should do if a client breaches their terms of business? And how about trying to maintain the relationship while that's happened?
Well, my simple advice here is get it in writing. It's no good phoning someone up and saying, you're breaching the contract, you haven't done this, you haven't done that. It may be that later in the day you need to rely on the evidence of when you notified of the breach. Keep it neutral. If you're going to do it in writing, just send an email saying, the contract required X, you haven't done X, I require you to rectify X within 14 days. If not, these will be the consequences, termination, whatever. But don't get angry in it. Just simply very clearly state, that's what should have happened. This is what has happened. This is the consequences of that. So that's neutral. The relationship's going to break down. It'll break down anyway. But if you get involved in an angry spat over it, you'll guarantee that the relationship will break down. Because it could be that someone's just made a mistake and they're just unaware that the problem has arisen. Don't go in all guns blazing to start with, but do get it in writing.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to say, this is what was supposed to happen. This has not happened. And this has been the adverse effects to me. So that you're showing that actually you're not just sitting here, you know, trying to be contentious by waving around a contract in someone else's face. But you're saying, look, this is what we've suffered as a result. Now, we want to put this all on track. We'd like this to, you know, to continue our good relationship and things like that. You know, as you say, Tim, keeping it neutral and friendly.
Yeah, I mean, there are times when you have to start getting the stick out and shaking it a bit more vigorously. But don't start with that. But I say, if you don't get it in writing, again, it becomes very difficult. If you later need to actually sue on these breaches to say exactly when the dispute arose, if you say, well, I spoke to X by phone on about this date, we probably discussed something along these lines, it's not very convincing.
Yes.
And then not only if you put the issue of breach in writing, it invites the response to be in writing. So if they say, well, actually, the reason we are not complying is because of X, then at least you know what their side of the story is, and it's crystallised at that point. Phone calls and text messages, which I've seen people engage in over contracts, it's not really very helpful.
Yes,
You know, this is a formal business arrangement. If there's going to be a breakdown or an allegation of breakdown, keep it formal as well. Because again, this comes back to the point we made about variations. If something has gone wrong and the parties need to change the arrangement because it's just not working, if you start the process of saying, this is what should have happened, this is what has happened, this is the consequence, we need to change something, that all needs to be put in writing. So everyone goes forward understanding what it is the changed obligations are, rather than simply thinking, well, we did have that contract, but then we did agree something, and I can't remember quite what that something was, to do something different.
Yes.
Because you're now into an opaque world of contractual obligations, and opaque contractual obligations aren't worth anything. No, because no one knows what they have to do or what they're paying for.
No, indeed. Tim, very, very sound advice. Thank you so much for your time today. I feel that we're definitely going to be up for a part two on this, because I've certainly got a lot more that's popping up in my mind as questions and areas that we can discuss that can be very helpful and useful to freelancers and self-employed people. So thank you so much for your time today, Tim.
My pleasure. As always, Hattie.
I will be seeing you again very, very soon. And I'd like to say to our listeners, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.